According to our trusty timepiece here, it's time to begin this session, session 321. I have a couple of announcements that you've heard already. Please close and turn off your cell phones, pagers, and other noisemakers. I've been trying to decide what other noisemakers are, and I don't know if that's loud chairs or just what it is. But anyway, we'd like to welcome you to this session. I'm particularly excited about it. I know that our respondent, Chuck Schofield, has been working very hard to get some environmental programs on the Sunstone program, and so I'm glad that he succeeded. Our presenter this morning is Stephen Peck, who is a professor of biology at BYU, has a keen interest in work in environmental issues, and so we're looking forward to hearing from him, Moab native, so right there in that heart of environmental conflicts. I also want to mention at this point that the book Stewardship and Creation, which is an edited book that Steve is one of the editors, based on a symposium that's held at BYU, is available in the bookstore, and that might be an interesting book for you to look at. Our respondent, Chuck Schofield, has just finished a master's degree from Claremont College of Theology in ethics, environmental ethics, and he's fallen in love with that area and is beginning a doctoral program, which seems intriguing to me, theology, ethics, and culture. So we'll look forward to Chuck's response. So let me turn the time now to Stephen, and we will go from there.
Thank you. We seem few in numbers. I hope this isn't representative of environmental concern in general. There we go. That's right. Thank you. I wanted to start off with this. Give you some sense of why I became interested in the environment, and it started when I was an undergraduate, actually. And I had a deeply spiritual experience at BYU. This was back in the days when Eugene England was putting together his Food for Poland program, and I was very interested in participating. And I had a tiny amount of money that I wanted to donate, but I had earmarked it for the Save the Whales Foundation. Now, since that time, Save the Whales has become almost a kitsch version of environmentalism. But at the time, I was genuinely concerned, and I was torn in half. I thought, what should I do? These are genuinely hungry people in Poland that could benefit. This was a pittance. This was an undergraduate tiny amount that I was going to donate. But to me, it was a widow's mite. It was quite a bit, and I wrestled with this. I thought, what should I do? Should I choose Save the Whales or Food for Poland? There was obviously some reason to think, well, maybe the hungry of Poland matter more than whales, and I couldn't get my mind around which to choose. And so I actually knelt down in sincere prayer, one of the most sincere prayers I've ever given, to see if it was okay if I donated money to Save the Whales. And I would consider one of the most profound experiences of my life, because at that moment, I had a sense of the Lord's concern for His creatures. It was almost as if I saw a piece of His mind and understood that He knew these whales. He couldn't see them from above. He wasn't watching them from some faraway objective and just knew where they were, for example. But He knew their names, as it were. And this had a profound effect on me. And it generated this love of the environment, of the creatures that live here. And I begin this talk in the middle of an ecological crisis. Throughout the world, ecosystems are under threat, in maybe the greatest threat to life that we've seen since the Cretaceous, when the dinosaurs went extinct. The climate is changing under the influence of human inputs. The ocean fisheries are disappearing. Forests are being cleared and for development at an alarming rate. Coral reefs are dying worldwide, and many species and entire ecosystems are under threat. These threats are well documented and scientifically established. I'm not going to outline these threats because I think there's information. In fact, if you want to look at the current issue of Newsweek, there is a nice article on the efforts that went into claiming that global warming was a hoax. It traces the money and looks at the large companies that tried to keep that as a hoax. But there is a genuine scientific consensus about global warming. There is a genuine scientific consensus that the Earth is under threat and in danger. I also want to talk about an approach to living more harmoniously with the Earth. My intent is not. I'm not going to outline the doctrines that support this, nor am I going to give any practical advice on what you can do personally. But what I want to do this, and that's because this has been done by so many others. There's some great works on environmental ethics that I can reference, give you references for if you'd like. And there's also good references on how to live more ecologically to live ecologically. What I'm going to talk about today is change in perspective, and of seeing some of the animosity that exists between trying to reduce this animosity between, oh, these are some of the threats, between environmentalists, between the perception that somehow that this needs to be a political activity. Look at this picture, and two different colored blocks, right? The one up front. Anybody disagree that that's two different colors of blocks? Yeah, I cannot look at that and not see that it's two different colors of blocks. But if I block and there's no change in anything, they're the same, actually. You know, there's some tricks due to the shading, but literally those are the same color. And I think this becomes kind of a metaphor, I think, for the divisiveness I see about the environment in our world today, and I think it needs to be healed. I became an ecologist because I love complexity, and I love nature. And when I look at nature, there's much going on that's not only invisible to us, but it's deeply hidden in the relationships that form among living things and the non-living things of our planet. These relationships form the structure and fabric within which we live. They touch us constantly. The oxygen we breathe, the ecological processes that sustain our lives in an almost alchemical process combining sunlight, soil, air, water that move through cycles and cycles within cycling. These things are happening all around us and within you. I don't know if you know, but you're essentially 3 pounds of bacteria. If you weighed the amount of bacteria, that's always kind of a pleasant thought. But much of this amazing complexity is taken for granted, ignored, or even despised. And that is why I want to talk about reverence today. I hope today to challenge members of the church to think more deeply about their relationships to nature and its processes. I think we haven't lived up to our best selves nor our best doctrines. There are a lot of reasons for this, and I'm going to try and I'm really not going to try to dissect them today. I'm going to take a page from positive psychology, which considers the cause of our current state of mental unalignment as irrelevant and just work on getting better. And there is much to do. When I was a graduate student in ecology, people were often surprised that I was a Mormon ecologist. The Mormons, deserved or not, had a reputation of being not only unconcerned with the environment, but hostile to it. In fact, when the Ecological Society of America was going to have their national meeting in Salt Lake City, there was an active protest against having it here because of the well-known and abysmal environmental record of Utah legislatures and the anti-environmental attitudes of people in many parts of Utah. The disregard for preserving our lands and for the pervasiveness of development and other hints that we were not environmentally aware or literate concerned the society enough that they almost changed the venue. A few of us Mormon ecologists wrote letters saying this isn't the right attitude. And we do place a lot of emphasis on development. We do tend to make that a priority. This was taken outside of my house, and when we moved there, there were more natural areas. There were beautiful orchards, and just in 7 years, all of the orchards and all of the undeveloped land around where we lived has since been developed for housing. This is a quote from Hugh Nibley, giving further evidence for this sense that the world has that Mormons are not environmental. At the first meeting of Congress under the present administration, it was declared that the delegation from Utah was the most anti-environmentalist in the nation. Ecology and the environment are dirty words in Utah. These are two statements, one from Matt Olschlager, a professor of environmental philosophy, from his book Caring for Creation. He says, the only denomination that has formally stated its opposition to ecology as part of the church's mission is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Foltz, a religious scholar, says, Mormonism is an aggressive, profit-minded corporate culture full of people who have lost their way and who don't know who they are anymore. So this perception that Mormons are environmentally illiterate and uninterested is widespread, actually, in formal scholarship. In fact, Massey did an environmental report of positions of Christian denominations on the environment. And he broke it down into these four places that churches could be to be environmentally aware. But number one was programs underway, denominations with established national environmental programs beginning a response, denominations beginning to move at the national level, at the brink, denominations poised on the brink of national commitment, and for no action, denominations that have not yet begun to consider action. So let me ask you, just see if you can guess where they rated the LDS Church. Number four is a good guess, but I tricked you, because the answer is number five. Policies of inaction, denominations formally committed to inaction. This is amazing to me, and this is kind of the world I grew up in graduate school, and I thought things were beginning to abate, because there have been several good papers on environmental ethics since that time. But just as recently as a couple of years ago, if you follow animal behavior at all, you've probably read Mark Beekhoff's work. And in a letter to High Country News after an article on Green Mormons, he said, he wrote a letter to the editor called "Are Mormons Really Green?" in which he says, "Indeed, while there are many wonderful individual Mormons who hold admirable positions on environmental issues as a whole, I don't see how Mormonism can be rated highly for promoting and enforcing a comprehensive environmental ethic that respects animals for the amazing beings they are, individuals who are very important, some might say essential, for maintaining the integrity of innumerable precious landscapes and ecosystems." So where does this impression come from? Why do people think that Mormons are so environmentally unconscious? And sadly, I understood their perception, actually. I remember growing up in Moab, one of the worst insults you could give somebody is "your mother is an environmentalist." Those were fighting words. If somebody said that, you'd have to break into a fight. And I find even that some of my students who are environmentally active, tend to try to disown the word environmentalist because it has such negative connotations, and members of their families will criticize them if they claim to be an environmentalist. I'd actually want to redeem the word and reclaim it and sort of boldly say I am a Mormon environmentalist. But I understand that perception. There is this view that although people love nature, I mean, I've gone into the woods, gone into on hikes, and almost without exception, the people in my neighborhood who would condemn environmentalism, who don't recognize that environmentalism is something important or necessary, they love nature and they want to go out there. And so I think there's this disconnect. I think that there's this perceptional difference, like I showed with that cube. And how can we wake from this? How do we move people to a new place where they understand the importance of environmental concerns? One of my favorite scenes in The Lord of the Rings is when Merry and Pippin stumble into Fanghorn Forest and meet Treebeard and Ent, one of the shepherds of the trees. The forest is being destroyed by an evil wizard, Saruman. He explained that the Ents have been sluggish and slow to act. And speaking of Saruman, he says, Treebeard is kind of like a half-tree giant creature. He says, only lately did I guess that Saruman was to blame, and that long ago he had been spying out our ways and discovering my secrets. He and his foul folk are making havoc now. Down on the borders they are felling good trees. Some of the trees they just cut down and leave to rot. Orc mischief that, but most are hewn up and carried off to feed the fires of Orthanc. There is always smoke rising from Isengard these days. Curse them root and branch. Many of those trees were my friends, creatures I had known from nut and acorn. Many had voices of their own that are lost now forever. And there are wastes of stump and bramble where once there were singing groves. I have been idle. I have let things slip. It must stop. And then he adds, speaking of the Ents' sluggishness, if I could make them understand the need, if I could rouse them, we are not hasty folk. What a pity there are so few of us. Treebeard then calls this gathering of Ents, a grand council of Ents, and the Ents get roused. Suddenly the Ents are fully awake and ready to take action. The old Ent now took the hobbits back and set them on his shoulders again. And so they rode proudly at the head of a singing company. With beating hearts and heads held high, they had expected something to happen eventually. They were amazed at the change that had come over the Ents. It seemed now that as sudden as the bursting of the flood that had been long held back. In the end, the Ents do what no army in Middle-earth could have accomplished, and they demolish completely Saruman's terrible fortress. I'm hoping the Mormons are like that, that through a sort of Entmoot of ground root efforts, that the LDS will awaken to the threats we are facing, and the effect will be the emergence of a truly great force for the care of nature on our planet. And I've been thinking a lot about what we need to wake this slumbering giant. What form could it take? I've been exploring of lately the ways people of other faiths express their faith and show their care for the earth and move forward. Because I honestly do believe that if the LDS people became environmentally interested, it would literally change the world. It would be a force. We've seen that before with when people make a change. For example, when the things like the MX missile were coming to Utah, a sudden shift in people's perspective can change everything. And so let me share some of what I think is an interesting perspective. This is from Starhawk's book, Earth Path, and it offers the following blessing on a compost pile. And there is something magical and trusting about even thinking of offering a blessing on a compost pile. But she says, we offer gratitude to the great cycles of birth, growth, death, decay, and regeneration. We are grateful to all the beings who have made the great transformation, leaving the remains of their bodies here. We are grateful to all the hungry mouths that consume the dead. Blessings on the termite, the beetle, the ant, the spider, the worm. Blessings on the fungi and the bacteria and those that need air and those that avoid it. Blessings on all the life in this pile that will transform decay to fertility, death to life. May I always remember that the cycle of life is a miracle. May I continue to feel a sense of wonder and joy in the presence of death and life. May I remember that waste is food, and may my eyes be open to the opportunities to close the circle and create abundance and life. And there's something really beautiful about that blessing. To think even of blessing a compost pile, I think says something about the wonder and care of nature. And in fact, what assumptions do go into such a blessing? The first is that God cares about such things as compost piles. It shows an awareness of our dependency on the little things on earth, an acknowledgement that these diverse things matter to our health and well-being. The blessing requires some education in the workings of nature. You'll notice she had a fairly good feel for what sorts of animals and insects lived in that compost pile and how those cycles and ecosystems work. It shows a deep reverence for the ecological cycles that make life even possible. And it takes seriously that our spiritual lives can merge with nature and its care. Are there room for such attitudes in LDS traditions? I think so. I think how a more reverent attitude towards the sacred nature of creation could... We couldn't carelessly use our natural resources. When we hold something sacred, could we glibly... if we really had a sense of the sacredness of nature, if we really had a concern for it, could we glibly argue that certain of our companion species are less important than a new mall or a housing development? Such attitude as we find in this blessing on a compost pile would go far in sensing how important and how fragile our life support systems are and how important their care will be. There is something absurd, I think, about blessing a compost pile. Maybe as absurd as making a sacred covenant with the creatures of the earth. And in Genesis, though, we find that after Noah disembarks from the ark, we read the following. And God spake unto Noah and to his sons with them, and behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, of the cattle, of the beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast. The Lord then establishes his covenant that he will never destroy the earth with water again, and sets a rainbow to mark this covenant. And then the Lord adds, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and waters will no more become a flood. If you think about a covenant, it's always a two-way interaction between two parties. This is a covenant that the Lord made with the creatures of the earth. Now I want to ask, why should I take seriously the idea that the Lord made a covenant with Noah and with the creatures of the earth? I don't take literally the idea that there was a worldwide flood and an ark loaded with a sampling of each sex of each species. Why take literally that God made a covenant with the beasts of the earth? As I read this story of the flood, I don't think that I'm supposed to take lessons about physical geology and biodiversity from the story, but something deep about the Lord's concern for what are often called the lesser things of earth. Embedded deeply in our theology, there is the claim of human supremacy, and the Lord's ultimate concern for us, his children. But notice in the story, the Lord makes his covenant with Noah, his children, for perpetual generations, as in verse 12 of Genesis 9 tells us, and every living creature, us and them. This suggests to me that while we may be our Heavenly Father's ultimate concern, we are not his only concern, that these creatures do matter to him. After all, he commanded Noah to make sure he made it. They all made it on the ark. So for me, the thing to take a literalist reading on this story is not the elements borrowed from Near Eastern flood narratives, but the heart of the story, which shows a relationship between the care between Creator and all creation. That's the reason for the story being told here. The ark and the great deluge are metaphorical, but the Lord's care is genuine, deep, and important. His creation matters. His creatures matter. This was made explicit, actually, in a article by George Q. Cannon. And he said, Sunday, February 25th, is a day assigned for special instruction in our Sabbath schools about the subject of kindness to animals. There, 3 years ago, the Deseret Sunday School Union Board appointed last Sunday in February of each year to be observed as Humane Day. The desire was and is that on the particular day, lessons concerning the proper treatment of living creatures should be impressed upon the minds of children. We earnestly recommend that this year's Humane Day be generally and appropriately observed, and that superintendents and teachers put forth special efforts and have the lessons on kindness and humanity made as impressive and as interesting as possible. Moreover, it's interesting in the Noah story that the event that seems to have precipitated the Lord's anger was a kind of designing greed. Let me read from Robert Alder's translation of Genesis, chapter 6, verse 5. He says, "And the Lord saw that the evil of the human creature was great on the earth, and that every scheme of his heart's devising was only perpetually evil." The word scheme and of his heart's desire may be something we can find going on right here in our state, this scheme and devising to use the resources of the earth. President Kimball talked about this explicitly. He said, "But when I review the performance of this people in comparison with what is expected, I am appalled and frightened. Iniquity seems to abound. The destroyer seems to be taking full advantage of the time remaining to him, this great day of his power. I have the feeling that the good earth can hardly bear our presence upon it. The brethren constantly cry out against that which is intolerable in the sight of the Lord, against pollution of mind, body, and our surroundings." When I introduced the sluggishness of the saints in environmental concerns, we were directed to consider the ant. Now, the ant is mentioned in the blessing above. Let's look at the ant for a moment to see if there are lessons to be learned. And I'm careful here. In looking for lessons in nature, there is a long-failed tradition to look for messages from God in the workings of nature. In the Middle Ages, every aspect of nature was taken as a message from God. Natural theology is a dangerous activity. For as Darwin noted, if we're going to learn about the nature of God from the beauty of nature, what are we to learn from him about the existence of ichneumonid wasps that lay their eggs in the flesh of a living organism for their larvae to eat alive? The sacredness of nature is inherent in it, and not for what lessons can be drawn from its worth. I think Mary Oliver captures this in her poem. It's called "How the Grass and the Flowers Came to Exist, a God Tale." "I suppose," the Lord said, "let there be fur upon the earth, and let there be hair upon the earth." And so the seeds stuttered forward into ripeness, and the roots twirled in the dark to accomplish his desire. And so there is clover, and the reeds of the marshes, and the eel grass, and the sea shallows, and upon the dainty sea brant live. And there is the green and sturdy grass, and the goldenrod, and the spurge, and the yarrow, and the ives, and the bramble, and the blue iris covering the earth, thanking the Lord for their blossoms. She suggests to me that perhaps we should interpret scriptures such as, all things denote there is a God, all things witness that there is a supreme creator, as a relationship among the objects of creation themselves, and how they link to their creator, rather than a statement about inferences that we can make based on observing their behavior. This denote then brings in the connotations of a relationship with God rather than providing empirical evidence or a kind of natural theology. How do we denote there's a God? Are we not part of creation? Perhaps by joining the elements of the universe in a sense of mutual reverence and recognition. By recognizing nature is something that in and of itself stands in relationship with God as we do. That attitude is, I think, reflected in Starhawk's blessing on the compost pile. I think the lack of reverence is the root of why the saints have not risen to be the environmental leaders that their doctrines so clearly demand. This has been well articulated by many others. And when nature is seen only in terms of its economic worth or it as a commodity, it is hard to hold an appropriate reverence for its deep worth. Can we easily exploit that which we revere? Those things that we do hold sacred, like family relationships, scriptures, our meeting houses and temples, and such, we would be very slow to attach economic value to. Those things we reverence, we protect, we honor, and we enjoy. Is nature worthy of reverence? Can we recognize it as a gift for our use, but not for our abuse? Much as in a spousal relationship, it is one of use and being used by, but when it becomes one-sided or damaging to one spouse at the gain of the other, it is ultimately harms both. So in nature, when we recognize that it provides essential services, but we hold its components and processes in reverence, both can be blessed and benefited. And how do we cultivate this reverence to nature? I think the first step is getting to know nature and to reverence something. Reverence requires an intimacy and an acquaintance with nature. Notice that in Starhawk's blessing, there are specific references to ecological process. This knowledge is a result of the last 100 years of ecological study on processes and activities in nature that we've studied. I, for example, have studied ants, and they appeared in the world. Let me go back to that picture. They appeared in the world about 100 million years ago during the Cretaceous from wasp-like ancestor. There's been a temptation among the saints to read the scriptures as a scientific text. This is a mistake. There is something beautiful and important about viewing the creation as embedded deeply in time. The Jewish writer Abraham Joshua Heschel writes in his book The Sabbath, "Creation, we are taught, is not an act that happened once upon a time, once and forever. The act of bringing the world into existence is a continuous process. God called the world into being, and that call goes on. There is this present moment because God is present. Every instant is an act of creation. The moment is not terminal, but a flash and a signal of beginning. Time is in perpetual innovation." A synonym for continuous creation. Time is God's gift to the space of the world. If we picture creation as a simple wave of the hand, I think it devalues it and may suggest why the saints have sometimes not appreciated the immense work that has gone into the marvelous biodiversity that we see around us. The thought that it took millions of years have been required for creation goes far in helping us appreciating the uniqueness and preciousness of creation. I will not go into detail into my thoughts on evolution Mormonism, but there are many, just because there's so much being written about that, some of which I've written, but I do want to mention one thing. If you look at this and you think that it took literally hundreds of millions of years to make this beauty, this sculptured structure just in an ant, it makes it more valuable. This is an ant herding aphids. You can see it's tapping the back of this one and squirting honeydew into the ant's mouth. They herd them like cattle. If you've ever wondered if ants herd cattle, they do. I don't know what songs they sing around the campfire, but if we and so this perception of creation taking a long time through the mechanism of evolution. If we look at nature, we're looking into the deep creation of an eye not fashioned in a single instant, but gleamed from the elements of corpses of burned out stars back in deep time, we're peering deeply into our history. If we could peer into this deep history of our eye, we would see the history and beauty and magnificence of creation. Not a nature fashioned by the quick wave of hand, but something that has required just about 13.7 billion years. For example, oxygen and carbon had to be forged in an earlier generation of stars to create the building blocks of life. These chemicals were then fashioned using a time-demanding process of natural selection into the variety and wonder of those things that are around us. All this happened through fits and starts, long delays, and many amazing steps. Evolution proceeded much like the ants trying to move a caterpillar to their nest. If you've seen this, you notice that it's not a straight line process, and seemingly against the odds of many individuals pulling in seemingly random directions, the caterpillar gets to the nest. So quite literally, we are the stuff of stars. Our bodies, at least, were forged, our carbon, our oxygen, the elements of which we're made. And it appears from the fossil record that even our own bodies were forged in deep time. This is a forensic reconstruction of Homo ergaster, who lived along the shores of Lake Turkana 150 million years ago. This is what this was done by the people who, when they find a dead body, reconstruct muscle to the bone, then put on flesh so that they could see what this person looked like for identifying missing people. This is an actual forensic reconstruction of Homo ergaster, and if you look at that, there's a deep familiarity and a deep recognition that this is somehow our beginnings. We have a deep connection with all living things. I want you to remember, it was not Adam's body that made him central. Many think he came straight from dust, not from the convoluted path that seems indicated by the fossil record. But I'm biased. I like apes better than dust. So that's my preference. But what made Adam important was that his was the first body into which was placed a spirit child of God. Even so, our bodies matter deeply in LDS theology. They ultimately will be fused with our spirits in the resurrection. If we really are connected to nature in a way that I suggest... This picture left me stunned. There, floating in the void of emptiness, is our planet, a tiny speck in an infinite sea. No wonder that Moses was struck with our insignificance and declared, "Now I know that man is nothing, which thing I had never supposed." But this pale blue dot is a gift, and it needs our immediate attention. It's worth our reverence. It really is a holy space. So where do I think we need to move as a people to heal our environmental image? First, we need to take our doctrines seriously. We need to examine closely what the scriptures and our prophets, both ancient and modern, have said about stewardship responsibilities towards our earthly home, then act on what we find there. I think as we come to understand how deeply our doctrines engage with the idea of caring for creation, we will begin to reverence the time and energy that went into it. When we reverence the little things that matter so much to our continuance on this planet. Second, we must demand of our political leaders that we elect more attention to protecting our ecological history. We deserve better. Third, we need to become ecologically literate. We need to come to know and to love the ecological support systems of the Earth as we come to understand how precious and how precarious our ecological support systems are. I believe that appropriate actions will follow. Things like recycling, protecting our land, and preserving our wildlands will flow effortlessly from our sense of care and stewardship. As ant biologist E.O. Wilson has said, life on this planet can stand no more plundering. Quite apart from the obedience to the universal moral imperative of saving creation based upon religion and science alike, conserving biodiversity is the best economic deal humanity has ever placed before it since the invention of agriculture. It is time to act, my respected friend, is now. The science is sound and improving. Those living today will either win the race against extinction or lose it, the latter for all time. They will earn either everlasting honor or everlasting contempt. As Latter-day Saints, we have a great responsibility for preserving our planet. It is, after all, our permanent home. We understand that it is not a lifeless sphere to be used and abused. Our responsibility is profound. That we believe the earth was made for our progression in no way allows us to operate from a position of power and disrespect. It deepens our responsibility and the necessity of reverencing these processes that sustain and support life we have been given. The defining characteristic of ourselves and God may be our ability to act selfishly for the benefit of others. As theologian Charlene Burns points out, to say that humanity has responsibility as co-redeemers is not to say that the entire cosmos is about us. It is to say that since humanity appears to be the first species to evolve from the twin capacities for moral decision-making and awesome destruction, we must extend our theologies beyond the human realm and recall that, paraphrasing Luther, humanity does not live for itself alone, but also for all. Nay, humanity lives only for others. In all our works, we may serve and be useful to others in all, having nothing before our eyes but the necessities and the advantage of our neighbor. She, end of quote of Luther, and she continues, whatever species of life that neighbor may be, this truth, both hidden in and revealed by the evolutionary process, is made known through the suffering of God on the cross, which reveals to us the nature of God, altruism itself. And so let me end there and just encourage you to look more deeply into what our doctrines support and what is how important understanding our ecological place in the world is. Thank you.
In a world where the atmosphere is quickly filling with too much carbon dioxide, and in a culture that many times has too much hot air, Stephen's paper was most definitely a breath of fresh air. Stephen Peck addresses our ecological crisis coming from the field of evolutionary biology. I address the same problem from a very different field, theological ethics. I do not presume to be anywhere near as trained in theological ethics as Stephen is in evolutionary biology, but my point in making this distinction is that we are both approaching the problem from very different fields. They are, in fact, on opposite sides of the spectrum. I only bring this up because I agree with almost everything he said. But instead of simply saying amen and sitting down now, I will highlight a few of the things I really liked about this paper and point out some of what I wanted more of. First, the things I liked. My senses of awe and wonder and reverence were all enhanced by this paper. 13.7 billion years? Dang. All for me? Or all for us? Now what are we supposed to do with this gift that took so many years to make? Screw it up in a couple of hundred? There are few, if any, Mormons who might say that the earth was created in six 24-hour days by the wave of a wand. Most would be quick to correct someone and say, no, it's six periods. But they still treat creation the same way, as if it was created by the wave of a wand. My favorite part of the whole talk, and the part that I could talk about for hours and hours, I feel like, it was the analogy of the Ents. I thought that was a fantastic analogy. The more I think about it, the more I think it can apply to Mormons. How can we, who are so few, have that sort of huge impact? We heard the other day about a recent study that showed that Mormons were more likely than the average American to believe that one person could make a difference. But this goes a lot deeper. I think that the first sure indication that we could have a disproportionate impact is that we have a disproportionate amount of power, wealth, and influence in the United States. For example, we are overrepresented in Congress. The United States can, and in fact needs, to be the global leader in environmental reform, because the United States uses more resources than any other country in the world. Americans can have a disproportionate influence. Because Mormons have a disproportionate influence within the United States, they play even an even greater role. These points are not speculative at all, but this potential to be a force like the Ents goes deeper still. Because of Mormons' actual and or perceived location on the political spectrum, many believe that Mormons would be the last group to go green. No one is expecting Mormons to lead an environmental revolution. One of the most tragic imperfections of our current political system is that issues can become politicized while at the same time the people can become so partisan. However, look at the current recipe that is now coming to a boil. First, environmental issues are concerns of the left, or liberal, or democratic. Two, the country is very partisan, perhaps more now than ever. And three, Mormons are perceived generally to be the most conservative, and actually represent much of the three most conservative states. Who, then, has the most potential to make the greatest change? No one would see it coming, just like Saruman never saw the Ents coming. Mormons could shatter the idea that environmental concerns are not the concerns of conservatives. Shattering that stereotype could have an impact so large that all political stereotypes could be influenced. No longer could simple labels mean so much. If people actually had to explain what they meant by liberal or conservative, instead of all things being assumed and usually correct, then maybe we could get away from our soundbite culture, which could help change another problem, which could help change another problem, and so on and so on. We see it is not hard to see the interconnectedness of issues and problems, nor is it hard to see the potential Mormons have to be like the Ents. Now, some of what I wanted more of. I still don't quite understand how we got such a bad rap. I can see our lack of action with regards to environmental concerns, but I do not see the evidence for a policy of inaction. What was in print that no longer is that set these critics off? I know this paper wasn't about how we got the bad reputation, but I'm encouraged to go find out. In fact, I really appreciated the approach Stephen took from positive psychology, which simply focuses on getting better and considers the cause of our current state of mental unalignment irrelevant. I think the first steps that he outlined to attain this reverence for nature and to heal our environmental image are correct. They are especially helpful here, where many of us want some helpful direction. To cultivate a reverence for nature, step one was to understand and get to know nature. I do have one small complaint here, but it might not be valid. Somehow I got the impression that this referred to book knowledge. One could get more out of the compost heap prayer, for example, if they understood all the processes that went into it. I would add an explicit reference to experiencing nature. That might have been what you meant when you said get to know. But I think get to know could mean, you know, book knowledge, too. But coming from a guy that lays out in front of his house to watch ants for hours, you probably at least implied that book knowledge is incomplete without experiential knowledge. So all I would change would be explicit about the experiential. And then to heal our environmental image, to take step one, to take our doctrine seriously. Two, demand our political leaders that they pay more attention to environmental issues. Three, that we become more ecologically literate. And four, appropriate actions will follow naturally and effortlessly. I would only add a foundational step there at the beginning that I think many Mormons need, and that is to get to know the doctrines. They have to know them before we can take them seriously. We need to become ecologically literate with regards to our own tradition. Also on step two, when letting the politicians know that they should care more for the environmental issues, to make sure to let them know that you're Mormon if you don't live in Utah. So I have a comment about almost everything that was presented, and I could go on all day just about the Ents analogy, but I'm sure that many of us in the audience want to pick Stephen's brain, so I'll stop with that. Well done.
We have about 10 minutes for comments or questions. If you would come to the mic, please.
Yes, I want to make an observation that I think Stephen's paper to me affected me spiritually. I think it's a spiritual paper, and I would love to have a copy of it. But I have a question for Stephen in terms of the nonpartisan political process and the awakening awareness of the LDS community. And I do it with an observation that I'm a sociologist of religion, and I study the subject. But the evangelical Protestant right, that there actually is an awakening within that community, the so-called right-wing Protestant community, and that there is a dialogue or discourse that is taking place. And I was wondering if that discourse could be expanded in terms of the LDS community, in terms of, because I think there is some kind of at least political commonality, but then also that this evangelical community could kind of provide a cover for the LDS community to kind of step up to the plate. And I wanted to kind of speculate on that. The other observation that I think is, at least in terms of my view, what kind of retards the LDS community is because I think it has thoroughly embraced the capitalist system and the ethic of the profit, profit motive. I say profit in the other sense of the word profit. But that that's almost a spiritual embracing of that kind of materialistic paradigm, which to me, then, I think does inhibit any discourse.
I think that's right. I was rereading some of Hugh Nibley's condemnations of our obsession with affluence, our obsession with money and to get ahead, and we certainly have been guilty of that, and we haven't been I think paying attention to some of the foundational principles that say that these kinds of pursuits are not what our life is to be about. It seems as though in many circles in Utah Valley, things like development, things like having a bigger house than the next person, are a sickness. And I liked your comment about the evangelicals movement to environmental concerns. It's true. There is and it's interesting. It is a grassroots movement, much like I envision for the LDS, that people just are starting to be concerned about the environment, to write about it, to read books about it, to recognize that it's important. And I think it's spreading. I think one of the ultimate signs that of hope that I saw was my wife told me last night that Fox News has started a new segment at the end called Living Green. And I thought, oh my word, Fox News, that's almost miraculous. but thank you. I think that's right.
Quick question for either of you. I think that you're both very much right that individuals in the long run can make a huge difference, but there's a very tough paradigm kind of standing in our way, and that is, I think, a prevailing notion among Latter-day Saints is that the environment's going to be all taken care of in the end anyway, or that this is somehow part of the plan, that the eventual destruction of the earth, well, it's coming and burning, right? Mm-hmm. Global warming, you know? Mm-hmm. And you know, so I can demonstrate by my own actions, you know, environmental conscious living, and I can show people the science, and they can still say, oh, sure, that is true science, but it still fits in with this paradigm I have. So what do you do to get beyond that?
That's a great question, because it's true. I mean, that attitude among the LDS community sort of you saw in James Watt back in the 80s under Reagan, the idea that Christ is coming, why should we care? And the counter to that, I think, is that we're all going to die. We're all going to our end is sure. And that would not justify in any sense, though, not caring for grandma. I mean, if somebody said, well, grandma's going to die anyway, so what the heck? We can use her as any way we want, you know. Let's take out her garden, you know, redo her house or whatever. She doesn't matter because she's dead anyway. I mean, that would be appalling. We immediately would recognize the falseness of that kind of attitude. But I think that needs to be pointed out, that just because we believe that there is an end, it doesn't justify treating what's sacred as something we can abuse. Chuck, do you want to comment on that? He had some good thoughts on this, actually, in a previous session.
Usually that line of thinking is followed by, besides, if the prophet wanted me to do something about it, he would ask. He would tell me to. He showed President Kimball's quote. That's why I think that step one was right about taking our own doctrines seriously and knowing our own doctrines. And when they know a couple and they misapply them to global warming, it's not complete without the rest of the equation, you know. So to get to know our own doctrines, really become literate in our own ecological tradition.
I'm going to jump in here too, if I can. I approach the subject as a personal essayist and have written on the topic. I'm not nearly as optimistic as these guys are about. Let me say it this way. Yes, you can extract all kind of environmental eco-theology out of Mormon doctrine, just like you can extract that we're a peace-loving people and are opposed to war. But that doesn't mean that's the consciousness. And so here's my statement, which you can interpret as a question, which you've already raised, really. To produce an environmental consciousness among Latter-day Saints will come from either a major shift among general authorities from a transnational mentality to a creationist theology, or a surge among what Richard Paul calls Liahonas. And I'm not real optimistic that either of those are going to happen.
I guess I'm hopeful because I've seen that kind of change occurring among my students. as I taught environmental science and watched them come from these very sort of deeply conservative backgrounds where environmentalism was really seen as not something. I've seen them make the switch. I actually seen them going home and talking to their families about this. And so I guess I'm hopeful. I recognize this is not easy, and maybe my hope will turn out to be pie in the sky. I hope you're
right.
Yeah, I hope I'm right too. And hope's a valuable commodity. So I think it motivates me to keep trying to do these kinds of things. So
good.
I have a puzzle here. I know the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but I always assumed that the church was, in theological terms, post-millennials and not pre-millennials. And I'm not privy to that, but I'd like to have you respond, because when you're kind of saying the earth will be destroyed, there's this kind of apocalyptic thinking, it's going to be destroyed in the next 20 years or 30 years. Now, would it be true that the LDS community is being influenced by the premillennialist evangelical community that's seeping into Mormonism, like creationism, literal creationism? Is that taking place?
Yes.
That's because I think that's a real crucial, because Bob, the secretary, he's a premillennialist, and he was saying, hey, almost within our lifetime, that's going to take place, so cut every tree down. But I think there's a real distinction between premillennialist and postmillennialist. That's 1,000 years, extra years, that there's going to be a reign.
I'm not as familiar with the terms. I read can't remember his name. Underwood, is that
Grant Underwood?
Grant Underwood wrote a book sort of really detailing it, and I read it maybe 20 years ago, so I can't remember the details. But my sense is that my students and others have a sense that there is a coming millennium, and that they that's an event that could happen in their lifetime. That they and in fact, I had some students whose grandparents had patriarchal blessings that predicted that the millennium would begin. So there is this sense that maybe we don't need to take care of things, but it's interesting in the Doctrine and Covenants. I think it's section 51 or 52. I probably need to look it up, but it talks about them, the saints. It commands them to go buy some land, but it says treat it as if it's going to be used for perpetual generations, something along those lines. And so what I try to emphasize is regardless of when they think the millennium is going to occur, you know, whether it happens in their lifetime or not, they need to have this sense of care, that we have a responsibility. A former biologist at BYU named Paul Cox once speculated that when the Savior returned, he was going to be asking things like, where's my desert tortoise? Where's my pupfish? Where are the things that I provided here for you, for your care? And look around at the monstrous homes that we live in, and express great disappointment in what we've done with our heritage, and with our resources.
Officially, this session is over, and I'd like to thank you for coming. But of course, you can continue the discussion with Stephen and Chuck. Thank you very much.